Today on Against the Grain, we may take for granted that some regions do well economically, perhaps it's the pleasant weather that attracts skilled workers to them, and that others do poorly. But history shows that regions rise and fall. I'm Sasha Lilly, economic geographer. Michael Storper joins me to talk about the differing fates of regions. That's coming right up. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Why do some regions thrive economically? Places where it's easier to find work, perhaps even decently paid work, while others do not. Why do some areas of the country that once were the center of jobs and innovation end up desolate, like much of the Rust Belt? Is this unevenness something that one can bank on with capitalism, an inherent feature of the system? Joining me to answer those questions and discuss the differing trajectories of cities and regions, including those of the San Francisco Bay Area and Southern California, is Michael Storper. He teaches urban planning and geography at UCLA. He's also professor of economic geography at the London School of Economics and professor of economic sociology in Paris. Among his many works is Keys to the City: How Economics, Institutions, Social Interaction, and Politics Shape Development, published last year by Princeton University Press. Michael, could you begin by describing for us the process of urbanization historically?
Well, urbanization comes and goes throughout human history. The first cities are about 7,500 years ago, probably Jericho and other places in what we would call the Middle East today. But urbanization has had higher and lower levels in different parts of the globe, depending on what kinds of global empires you've got. So in, different regions, for example, in China, in South America, in Europe, in the Roman Empire, these were pretty highly urbanized places. But if we're talking about modern urbanization, it's really from the age of exploration, which means around the 1500s, you get an uptick in urbanization in Europe because there are these great trading centers that develop that are now hubs for the construction of a world system based on the Europeans going out and doing what they do in various other parts of the world. And then the Europeans also give a bump to urbanization in the Americas, right, where they need cities in part to extract the resources and ship them through their global system. And even as the Europeans get into Asia, they do the same thing. But the big thing with urbanization is the Industrial Revolution in modern times. So we're talking somewhere around 1800, where you get another strong uptick in urbanization in the parts of the world that are being strongly industrialized. So that largely means Europe and then North America and then a little bit later on in East Asia. And then you could say there's, if you want to fast forward, there's, of course, the contemporary era, which is an era of extremely powerful urbanization, and it's where urbanization goes global in a big way, in the same way that the economy goes global. So now we're seeing urbanization all over the world. There's countries where you might say the level of urbanization is already mature, like here in the United States. We're well over 90% urban, as is the case in Europe or Japan, but lots of the world isn't at that threshold yet. But many parts of the world are getting there. So certainly Latin America, parts of the Middle East, China, India continues to urbanize, and we notably crossed a kind of a milestone threshold last year where, according to most sources, about 50% or a little bit over 50% of the population of the planet now lives in cities for the first time that we know of in recorded history. So those are sort of like the basics about urbanization. And I guess one other thing you could say is that the 21st century will very likely be the most urban century of all because of the probable continuation of that process of pulling people out of the countryside and into metropolitan areas.
Sure. And before we get to the 21st century, let me ask you about the contours of urbanization in the 20th century. What characterized the urbanization process, especially in the United States, during that time?
So two things could be said, I think, if you take the long sweep of the 20th century. The first was, of course, the continuation of the, we might say, the Industrial Revolution. In the late 19th century, after the Civil War, the United States shifts to being a decisively urban country. And that has to do a lot with the growth of heavy industry in the Northeast and the Midwest, and the U.S. as a developing country that rises to the top of the ranks of developed nations with its prowess in industry and technology that come against a background of building many great cities, mostly manufacturing cities, mostly in the Northeast and Midwest. So that's, if you will, the early 20th century is largely about that. But then you get a second process that happens starting in the mid-20th century, which is the shift out of those old core regions in the Northeast and the Midwest and the buildup of what we would popularly call the Sun Belt and its urbanization, and then also a process that's linked to that but isn't exactly the same one, and that is the urbanization here of the Pacific Coast. The Sun Belt is particularly interesting because it's where a century after the Civil War, the South finally starts to come out of being an agrarian society and begins to transform itself into being an urban one. But accompanying all of that is a massive shift in the demography of the United States.
And where does suburbanization fit into that history?
Well, urbanization is, it's a sign that of the kind of society that you have. So at any given moment, you get different kinds of cities. There are cities based on, for example, global commerce. That might be, Antwerp or Venice in the 1550s or, London in the 1700s or Madrid in the 1500s. Here in the U.S., our cities have largely been based on first manufacturing. So that's the great push after in the late 19th century and early 20th. And then manufacturing's move out of part of the country into the South and creating manufacturing cities in the Sun Belt. And then you get the shift of all of those to cities being more and more about, we might say, post-manufacturing types of activity, with the manufacturing spreading out of cities. So cities are they're a reflection of what the economy is doing, actually. They're almost like the physical reflection of what kind of economic transition you're going through, right? They also reflect broader political and social trends. So the rise of the Sun Belt here is, I think, you can never overestimate its importance to the development of the United States, to its and to the politics and society of the United States. Because to put it bluntly, the Sun Belt has a different social model in its cities from what the Northeast, Midwest, and even the Pacific Coast do.
And how do you characterize that social model?
Well, I mean, the South is very clearly much less enthusiastic about government. It's much less enthusiastic about a regulated form of economy. It is much more politically conservative. The cities in the South, interestingly enough, they're more liberal than the South as a whole, but then the cities in the South are more conservative on average than the cities in the Northeast, Midwest, and Pacific Coast. So they kind of reflect the regions that they're in. But because most people live in cities, we're more and more talking about cities when we talk about anything, right? And cities are the leading edge of this kind of where things happen politically, although you can also get backlash against them, right? People in the countryside often, this is throughout history, not just here in the U.S., you know, there's always the kind of country-city split, with cities being sort of more avant-garde and the countryside oftentimes feeling resentful about them.
Sure. And with the rise of the Sun Belt, obviously one can also look at the fate of formerly industrial cities in what gets called the Rust Belt. But in the late 1980s, 1990s, some cities in the Northeast also, some really went further down. Others had one might call it renewal, or perhaps something more negative, depending on your point of view. What would you say characterize that shift for cities like New York City?
Okay, so there, I would characterize two things about an urban system. One is you've got a big pattern. So you've got, you know, switch from manufacturing to non-manufacturing activities. You've got the switch from Frost Belt or Rust Belt, if you want to call it, the Sun Belt. Those are kind of the macro patterns. But within that pattern, you get a lot of what I would call selectivity and turbulence, meaning that the fates of individual cities are quite variable. And so in the Rust Belt, you get quite a number of cities that have very hard times, right? They lose employment and population, and some of them actually go down the ranks of incomes in the United States. But on the other hand, you get other cities like New York City that go down for a while, have a hard time from deindustrialization, and then they resurge or they bounce back. Because what happens to them is they find a successful role in the new economy. They switch from being an old economy city to a new economy city. That's the case for, in the Rust Belt, places like Boston and New York, right?
And when you
are very successful.
And when you say new economy, are you talking about industries that are focusing on technology? And if you're talking about a city like New York, finance obviously is still
right.
Central.
I mean, the new economy, the leading edge industries that you find in cities in the new economy are related to the whole sort of financial services part of the economy, which has grown greatly as a share of the economy as a whole, and it's very unevenly located. So finance is about double the share of the economy as a whole now from what it was in the 1970s, and it's very spatially concentrated. It's not, you don't find equal amounts of this growth everywhere. So New York is a supernova in finance. And of course, technology-based industries, everything from information technology to biotech and all the kind of new, we might call it new science-based capitalism that we have. And then a whole host of industries that are, we might call, specialized, high-quality production of design-based goods, the fashion industries, all of that stuff that goes with, we might say, upper-end consumerism. They are also highly urban industries, and they're very much new economy industries. So those three groups characterize the new economy, and they have a geography that's very urban, but even within that, they don't go to all cities in equal proportions. So you get finance centers, you get tech centers, and so on and so forth. And just going back to a point you made earlier, so this turbulence thing is very important. When the economy shifts from one pattern to another, there's an issue of which cities are the winners and which cities are, in a sense, the losers. And that pattern is highly variegated. In the Rust Belt, you get a lot of cities that go down and never come back. You get a bunch that come back, at least in terms of incomes and to some extent jobs. You get some others that once again gain population after losing it. And then in the Sun Belt, you get a bunch of rising cities, but they don't all rise in the same way. You get some cities that are bigger on population growth, but not so great on income growth. You get others that become bigger and richer. That's a little bit more favorable. You get others that get bigger for a while, and then they kind of stagnate. So again, the map of cities is uneven. There's kind of a pattern there that's pretty hard to discern with the naked eye.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and I'm speaking today with Michael Storper. He is professor of urban planning and geography at UCLA and also holds appointments in Paris and London. So this unevenness that you've been describing, that you say is a fundamental part of the urbanization process, is this something that we can tie to capitalism itself, that is a process that's inherent and a sort of necessary feature of the system? Is that too easy an answer? How do you understand that tremendous unevenness?
So I would say it's a bit too easy of an answer, but it's a really good question. Urbanization has always been uneven. And in each different political economic system, you get certain motors of unevenness. So if you go back to urbanization in the ancient empires, which were not capitalist, you still get cities where you concentrate the wealth and the power of the system. So some systems, they urbanize where the power of the system is military power or religious and ceremonial power, sometimes a combination of the two. As you move forward into political economic systems that are capitalist, you do get specificities of that, though. You get things that are added on. And there, what you get is the natural dynamic of certain kinds of activities in capitalism to be urbanized and other types of activities to spread out. And that's just because you there's a market logic to how activities locate. To put it kind of in a soundbite, the activities that are highly innovative, where they have really changing markets, where the technology is new, where there's a lot of new kind of knowledge, and where you really need four types of face-to-face interaction between the people who work in them, those are the activities you're going to see clustering in cities. When you get activities in the economy that are more mature, in the sense that their technologies have been around for a while, they have really big markets, they can produce with very, we might say, routine methods and economies of scale, those are the activities that tend to be able to liberate themselves from cities, and liberate in the sense that they get away from the really high land and labor costs that you have in cities. And that's where you get them moving out of cities, either within the United States or, in a more radical version of that, they go offshore. So there's this split pattern of urban, less urban, according to the kind of the parts of the economy you're talking about within capitalism, right? And it shifts from one period of capitalism to another. Manufacturing was very urban in 1900. By 1950, manufacturing was moving out of cities. Then what's replaced it in cities are these new economy activities, right? So you regenerate employment in cities, but the cities are totally different from the ones they replaced. So yeah, there's a specific logic to it, which is, you know, the market mechanism is dominant in capitalism, and land and labor prices are the things that basically determine what goes in and out of cities, as opposed to, say, the military or the religious or ceremonial elites want to be in cities, right, in, say, ancient empires.
So are you saying then that the primary driving force is around production, the cost of production, rather than, say, people saying, well, this is a lovely place to be and I want to migrate to that area, or this place, for whatever reason, has so many more foreclosures, so it's not a tenable place for me to live, or maybe this is the place I want to go because it's now cheaper?
Yeah, so now you're raising another one of the really big debates that happens among the people who think about urban growth and urbanization, which is, on the one side, there's a view, you know, and I have many brilliant colleagues who have this view, which is that the thing that determines whether cities grow or decline is basically whether they are nice or not, or whether they're attractive to individuals and households. So a lot of scholars today, they talk about what they call amenities. You know, is there a pleasant environment? Are there nice neighborhoods? Is the climate good? And is there low crime? And is there, let's say, abundant, attractive housing and all that? And the story they tell is that the urban system gets reshaped when people vote with their feet. They decide that they want to go somewhere, and they go there. And in this view of things, the people go first, and the jobs follow them. So the story they would tell about the Sun Belt is, or even the Pacific Coast, is that at some point in the 1940s and 1950s, people got tired of living in cold weather, and they got tired of expensive housing, and they kind of picked up and went to Houston and Dallas. And as a result of them picking up and going to Houston and Dallas, the productive economy, that is, industries and jobs, followed them. You could reverse that story. And the second story is the one that I happen to believe in as a scholar, which is that the jobs went first and the people followed. And, for example, if we take the case of the Sun Belt, I think that the key events that set off the development of the Sun Belt were, first of all, that a bunch of industries that used to be in the Northeast and the Midwest, in the Rust Belt, they matured, and they really didn't need to be close to these old cities anymore because they could create really big factories, and they could get their inputs, what they need, their supplies, and they could ship their products really far. So liberated from that, where did they go? They followed, first of all, I think the key event was that the South became open to industrialization. It was almost a century after the Civil War, and the South was in a way ready to not be poor and agrarian anymore. And they made a particular decision, which is in 1947, the South opted into the right to work law, which had been enacted by Congress in the Taft-Hartley Act, which allowed states essentially to opt out of the closed shop regime that is the case in the Northeast. And so that made labor conditions dramatically different in the South from the North. Already, wages were really low in the South because it was an agrarian area, right? But in addition to that, it now became very different for a union to organize itself in the South as opposed to the North, which at that time was a very heavily urbanized and unionized area. And what you saw was the beginnings of Southern industrialization. That is, factories started moving, especially the mill-based industries started moving from New England to the Carolinas in this period and Georgia. And that set off a new geographical pattern for the old economy as it slowly but surely began to relocate away from expensive, unionized northern cities to the Sun Belt. And I think what happened from there is that the people started following, meaning you started getting unemployment in the North and more job opportunities in the South. And then there was kind of like a snowball process in the sense of a kind of, you know, you get more jobs in the South, you get people moving in, the people moving in create local economies, you get more jobs, and so on and so forth. And the federal government, of course, was in the end also a big, we might say, a handmaiden to this process, because a little bit later, the country gave itself a transportation system in the form of the interstate highway system, which made it a lot easier to serve national markets from the South. Other things happened to make the South more attractive to live in. Housing was and still is much cheaper in the South than it is in the Northeast or on the Pacific Coast. So that meant that, in a sense, the employers got a double benefit from moving to the South. They could pay lower wages just because it's a poorer area, but in addition, people get more for their money there in terms of housing. So in a way, you don't need to pay them as much. So it's a very winning deal for the employers. And that's, I think, what set the story off. And that relates to a contemporary debate. People often say today that places that are very successful, like the Bay Area, are successful because they're nice, right? And the Bay Area is really nice, right? It's got great climate, and it's got beautiful landscapes, and all kinds of cultural amenities, and so on. We say that a lot. You know, New York grew again starting in the 80s because they cleaned up Manhattan, and Manhattan has art galleries and all these cool things. I think that's fundamentally reversing the causes of urban growth. The Bay Area has grown a lot because the Bay Area is a world capital of the technology industry. It's an incredibly job-rich place. The same thing is true for New York. New York grew, again, because it captured the financial industry. And people follow, right? People follow jobs.
Sure.
That's the big split. And if you will, that's the big debate about urbanization here in America.
And I'll ask you more about the Bay Area and the fortunes of cities on the Pacific, but I wanted to ask you a bit more about the role of policy. So you were describing with the South, the Sun Belt, that anti-union policies help facilitate the growth of production under low-wage terms there. Obviously, though, cities and regions have different tools available to them, or fewer tools available to them than, say, national economies in trying to foster development. To what degree are cities or regions successful in trying to create the conditions for innovation and growth?
You're getting at something very important here. Their cities and regions are not basically levels of government here in America, right? Your basic levels of government are you've got federal government, you've got the states, and you've got counties, and you've got cities. But the scale at which economic development happens for cities is actually the metropolitan region that they're part of. That's where the wealth, the labor markets, the land markets, they operate as a kind of unified whole. There are more and less rich neighborhoods within them, but fundamentally these are highly interdependent economies. And we don't have regional government in the United States, and we don't have anything like meaningfully operational regional economic development agencies. What we have usually are collections of, in the case of large metropolitan regions, usually several hundred local cities and some overlays from county government, and then a few places where they talk together, like what are called councils of government. But there is no level of government that is assigned with regional economic development. So there's a funny kind of mismatch between reality and formal governmental capacity here. Now, does that mean that regions can't shape their fates to some extent? They do, but we don't know a lot about how much they do. So local governments, they have a lot of power, for example, to shape land use, who can come in, who can go out. The federal and the state and the county governments, they generally deal with roads and bridges and infrastructure. That has some effect on how a regional economy works. Then you have school systems, right? They affect, you know, how skilled your people are. You have a variety of other things like, you know, good government that creates better and worse environments. But all in all, it's not clear how much regions can do to shape their fates in the medium to long runs. Now, if we look at, say, the difference between the richer metropolitan regions in America and the poorer ones, and let me actually give people a figure here. The richest metropolitan regions in America, places like the San Francisco Bay Area or Washington, D.C. or Boston, they have a per capita income of about $75,000 to $80,000 per year. The poorest ones, places like Brownsville, Texas, have per capita incomes of $23,000 per year. That's a 1-to-3 difference. So the question is, why are they different? You know, why are some areas so much richer, and did they do it? So, and that's one of the great mysteries. You know, why why do the industries that pay high wages go to places like San Francisco? And why do industries that pay low wages go to, say, Brownsville, Texas? Part of that's just the geography of the economy is you win or you lose, right? You win in the lottery if you get the high wage ones, and once you get them, they just keep going. But part of it probably is the quality of your local environment. You know, what are the skill levels you're giving to people? What are the health conditions? What are all of those things that you can shape? Here's the problem. You can shape them, but if you're a poor region and you're educating your people, the problem is a lot of them are going to leave. That's true for neighborhoods too, right? You go in, you successfully educate people, and what they'll do is they'll take their skills are portable, right? So a lot of the reason the Bay Area is wealthy, or New York's wealthy, or LA's wealthy even, is that the people who have skills, wherever they got them, they come to these places. So you can't automatically raise your region's economic profile through education. You have to not only educate people, but you have to keep them. So, or as we economists would say, you have to do the supply and the demand side. And that's tricky. You got to hold the people that you educate. And that's to say, it's exactly like what happens to developing countries who put a lot of investment in education. And then what happens if there's no jobs for the people? They don't want to drive cabs on the streets of Lagos. They move to London. And it's exactly the same problem for cities.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly, and today we are talking about urbanization and what makes city regions grow, thrive, at least economically, and what makes them decline. I'm speaking with Michael Storper, professor of urban planning and geography at UCLA. He also teaches at the London School of Economics and has an appointment in Paris as well. He is the author of many books, including Keys to the City: How Economics, Institutions, Social Interaction, and Politics Shape Development. That's published by Princeton University Press. Among many honors he holds, he was elected to the British Academy in 2012 and also received the Regional Studies Association's Award for Overall Achievement. Well, let's talk about the trajectory of two different regions, which are not all that far apart from each other, and that is Southern California versus the Bay Area in Northern California. And I happen to be conducting this interview from the Bay Area, and you are in Southern California right now. What history did these two regions have in terms of their economic development, their economic success and success as urban areas in the earlier part of the 20th century?
Yeah, so California is the contrast between our two world-class metropolitan regions in California is, I think, a great example of, it's a great way to think about the transformation of the U.S. economy as a whole. So in the 20th century, you know, San Francisco was, of course, the early established metropolitan region of California. And Los Angeles was the latecomer. It didn't have the early firms. You know, it developed after a good half century after San Francisco. And what happens in the 20th century is that Southern California becomes probably the world's most successful example of regional economic development, in the sense that it goes from being a relatively small metropolitan area to being a huge one. It adds millions and millions of people and does this in a period of about six or seven decades. So it's smaller than the Bay Area at the beginning, and it ends up being twice the size of the Bay Area by, say, 1970. But actually, Southern California's growth is not only interesting because it's, we might say, quantitative. It's also qualitatively good growth. Southern California's income levels, they start out much lower than the Bay Area, and by the middle of the 20th century, it has caught up. So Southern California is sort of like the developing country, and it does everything right. It becomes bigger. It becomes, in fact, twice as big as as its initial sort of example region up north. And it becomes just as rich. And then what happens, so we get now to, say, 1970, and we're at what we might call the end of the old economy period. Now we have two big metropolitan regions in California. California is a very wealthy state in 1970. Both of these regions are, so to give you the statistic, if you rank American metropolitan regions in 1970 by the level of per capita income that they have, San Francisco Bay Area is number one, and Los Angeles is number four, and the difference between them is 3 or 4%. So they're almost identical, right? They're very rich regions. If you, and then everything changes, meaning that Los Angeles's stellar performance starts to slide. So that if you fast forward to today, Los Angeles, which was number four in 1970, is number 25 among metropolitan regions in the country, whereas the Bay Area is still number one in incomes. So something goes wrong with Southern California in the new economy period. It just doesn't make it the way the Bay Area does.
And why do you think that is?
So that's actually the one of the most hard, it's a very hard question to answer. There are things you can say descriptively about the two regions that are different in this period. So first of all, both of them have a lot of population growth, but the population growth is different because the immigration streams are different. In the Bay Area, there is a higher proportion of Asian immigrants who have much higher education levels on average than do Latino immigrants from this period. In Southern California, you get more Latinos, less Asians. So part of it is the demographics are different. Part of it is, but I'll come back to that because I don't think it's actually a cause. I think it's more an effect, and I'll say that in a minute. Second thing that happens is that the Bay Area wins out in the lottery, we might say, of getting new economy industries. It becomes the world, through Silicon Valley, the Bay Area becomes the world high-tech center. And that does not happen in Southern California, even though Southern California was an early player in the semiconductor revolution. It had incredible high-tech resources through the aerospace industry, but it never manages to transform them into a dynamic, commercially oriented high-tech economy like as happens in Northern California. Third, the Southern California gets these, we might say, bad hits. The end of the Cold War really hurts the aerospace defense industries in Southern California, and those are high-wage industries. And it never really recovers those kinds of jobs. Fourth, I think, that goes on in Southern California is it loses a lot of corporate headquarters. It's just the Bay Area is not a great center of corporate headquarters either, but it's not quite as catastrophic in the north as in the south. And those are high-wage, high-skill jobs. So all of those things go on. The economic base and the labor force change really differently in the two regions. But I think those things actually don't explain it, because in a lot of ways, L.A. was set up to be it should have been a major player in the new high-tech world. And Los Angeles does have one sector that was almost new economy before anybody else was, and that's Hollywood. Sure. Hollywood, by the 1950s, was abandoning its old ways of doing business, the studio system, the factory-like organization it had, and it became this totally networked economy starting in the 50s and in the 60s. And Hollywood is still L.A. is still the uncontested center of entertainment production. It's bigger now than it's ever been. It's a bigger part of the regional economy than it's ever been. But it's not big enough to sustain a region of almost 18 million people. Whereas high-tech in the Bay Area is big enough to sustain the Bay Area economy. It's, in proportional terms, high-tech in the Bay Area is 5 times as big as what Hollywood is to its region. So there's those kind of things. But let me sort of go to a deeper level. I think the real issue, the real thing that happened, at least in Southern California, is that its firms and its business leadership never really figured out how to adapt to the new economy. They never kind of got it. that we were in a new world. And there was some luck in the Bay Area, frankly. You know, in the early days, it's not clear why, like I say, high-tech went to the Bay Area and didn't go to Boston or lots of other places. But once it got it, the Bay Area adapted really quickly. It got sort of focused on the idea of being a high-wage, high-skill economy in a way that the leadership down here in Southern California, they never latched onto that issue. My team, in the research we did on this, we analyzed actually what the major business leadership organizations did in the two regions over the last 40 years. And the whole discourse in the Bay Area is very different from the way that people talk about things down here. And I think part of that also is that down here in Southern California, people were very preoccupied by social crisis. And that's a natural thing. We had in the 70s, 80s, well, more in the 80s, 80s and 90s, lots of problems of social injustice, civil unrest, inequality, homelessness that were much bigger than in the Bay Area. And I think what it did is it kind of sucked up all the air, right? They just had to deal with these crises, and no one could really turn themselves to this question of, in the meantime, where's the economy going and what do we need to do for economic development? It's kind of caught up in, as it were, putting out the brush fires. So a lot of different things happened to the two regions.
And connected to that then, those social questions that you were saying were preoccupying people. When you talk about the income rank of Los Angeles in the 1970s and now in the Bay Area then and now, what do the numbers tell us about the distribution of income then and now? Obviously, the Bay Area has all of these high-wage jobs, and Los Angeles certainly has a lot of concentrated wealth as well. In looking at the health of these sort of leading industries like high-tech in the Bay Area, what does it say about how people are doing in the larger economy?
Okay, so background, first of all, is that both Southern California and the Bay Area reflect the trend toward greater inequality that is the case for the entire national economy. So California as a whole has a higher level of inequality than the United States. The United States as a whole has a much higher level of inequality now than it did in the 1970s and 1980s. And so that's the background. However, against that background, Southern California and Northern California are not very different in their distribution of income. That is, you know, we have calculated it in our research, and the curve of the distribution of income, or let's call it the inequality between the different levels, is about identical in the two regions, but it's pretty high by national and world standards for both of them. Now, what that means, though, is that in the Bay Area, you've got a lot of inequality, but at almost any level of the income distribution, that is, if you're a low, a medium, or a high-income person in the Bay Area, you tend to be, on average, richer than the person in Southern California who's at the same level of the distribution down here. And what that tells you is, I know this kind of goes against popular perceptions, and the popular perception, I think, is we're all feeling that it's not just a perception. We live in a society that's much more unequal than it was in the recent past. The difference, though, is that in the Bay Area, people at lower ranks in the income distribution are considerably wealthier on average than their counterparts in Southern California. And I can even give you really detailed examples of it.
And is that based on income or
overall? That's based
on
income.
The reason I ask is, of course, for people who are living in the Bay Area, there is a great deal of conflict right now, particularly in San Francisco, about high-tech workers driving the cost of living up in the area so that people can't afford, who are not high-tech workers, can't afford to rent an apartment in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. The amount, I think I heard recently, a one-bedroom apartment is now going for $3,000 a month. And so there's a great deal of resentment. Now, it's a complicated affair, but I think people would say, well, they're making the cost of living so high that even if my income might be a bit higher, it's offset by these things.
Yeah, so I think there's actually two scales to that phenomenon. The first scale is the regional scale, and what we mean by that is that in the Bay Area as a whole, the 10-county Bay Area as a whole, the population does not have a more unequal income distribution than they do in the 5-county Southern California region. And that, by the way, is after you correct for the local housing crisis. So these are things where we've taken into account the cost of living. However, what happens, of course, is that these region-wide phenomena play out at local scales very differently. So you get, in both metropolitan regions, you get the phenomenon of the inequality of the society as a whole is reflected in concentrated local income peaks. Basically, the rich people want to live in cities nowadays, whether it's L.A. or San Francisco, and they drive up neighborhood housing prices in a very kind of concentrated place. So you get these examples of gentrification and people being pushed out, which is a consequence of all this income being highly urbanized. But it's important to kind of separate that out from the notion that the average person in the Bay Area, to put it bluntly, frankly, they've done pretty well over the last 30 years. But I don't mean to say that means that it's all, you know, distributed in a socially just way among the people and the places of the Bay Area, right? That's kind of what we geographers call a scale question that you have to be really careful about understanding. It's just that these things play themselves out in a kind of a strange, you know, geometry, right? And part of that is, of course, that the future of San Francisco, if you continue to have a very successful economy in a place like San Francisco, and you know, hopefully you will, but you want it to not become homogeneous in income terms, you're faced with having a housing policy that will deal with that. That's the key issue there.
I just wanted to ask you, since this region, that is the Bay Area, has been a place where unionization has been more widespread, is that something that has influenced wages in some way over the long term? I mean, the long term being the period that we're talking about since the 1970s. And how would L.A. contrast or not in that respect?
Well, you know, that's another interesting dimension of the contrasting pathways of the two regions. Historically, the Bay Area was a more union-friendly region than Southern California, and the unions, you know, were heavily... they were powerful in, for example, the port industries and so on in Northern California. The IT industries are basically not unionized. And in both regions, of course, are faced with the decline of unionization in America in general, right, with the end of the old economy. Paradoxically enough, Southern California, and especially Los Angeles County, is probably one of the most vibrant areas for new labor organizing in the entire country. It's just that the labor organizing goes on in areas of the economy that are different. We don't just, the manufacturing here, the manufacturing industries are so weakened that there's not a lot of labor organizing going on them. On the other hand, if you look at the service industries, the healthcare industry, the public sector, and to some extent the port and logistics industry, LA County is probably for unions one of the bright spots in not such a great national picture. And in a lot of ways, the Bay Area is a lot less union-friendly place than it used to be, because its high-tech economy doesn't really have much unionization. How that figures into their contrasting pathways of economic success is a bit actually hard to discern at this moment. you can't really put kind of a causal link there on what happened.
I'd like to end by asking you about the future of these two regions, Southern California, the Bay Area, and I guess I'm asking you to be an oracle for a moment. Given what you've said about the unevenness that is fundamental to the processes that you've been discussing of urbanization, the shift of production into different regions, what do you think is the ultimate future of these two regions? Will the place that is doing better remain so? Can we look to the past to predict the future? Or could the fortunes of the two be flipped?
So I think that's a really interesting question. So what I would say is this. One thing we know from studying metropolitan regions is that nothing is forever. You know, we live in an economic system where the cards get dealt out and then the deck gets shuffled again from one period of development to the next, and that leads to this turbulence. So if you were to put yourself in Detroit in 1955 or 1960 and in Boston at the same time, most people would have bet on Detroit. It was, in a sense, the Silicon Valley of its day. It had technology. It had great companies. It was, admired, incredibly high-income city. It had incredible cultural institutions and wealth. And we know what happened. And so I would actually say that it's when you're at the top, as for example, the San Francisco Bay Area is right now, that you really have to think about the medium term. And the bottom line is that for all of their, astounding worldwide dominance, the IT economy of the Bay Area, it's maturing, right? It's a bunch of gigantic companies now, and it's not the same kind of culture and process that got it started and built it. So the Bay Area, I would say, it's a good time to start the conversation is when you're on top. And the same thing, of course, in parallel and in Southern California is this region here needs to have a frank conversation about why it did well in the past, what went wrong, how can the resources of the region be recombined into things that the economy wants to generate better, more high-skill, high-wage jobs for the people who are here. And I'm not at all pessimistic about Southern California, and I really think that's actually the kind of the term that I use is that we don't have regional governments, so we don't really have a place to have the conversation, but we can have them in other kinds of forums. And the thing is to have some perspective on the urbanization and economic development process, so that we get these conversations going, so we can actually talk about where we are, and where we want to go together. In these periods of change.
Well, Michael Storper, I'd like to thank you so much for your time. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you for talking with me today.
Michael Storper teaches urban planning and geography at UCLA. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening. And please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.F. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio.